In a tremendous race of people who are going to be mentally ill. He says it's terrible, it's horrible, it's fantastic. I'll say it is. Now, the question that we must answer tonight, if we possibly can, is how did these records get in your homes and in your school systems? And it's really to ask the question is to give a very simple answer. You know, I guess conservatives have been more or less labeled as being very simple people with very simple answers to complex questions. Well, tonight, I have a simple answer. I don't know if you'll accept it, but I think I know why these records are all over the country. Now, these records were... The record companies were set up in 1946, but they never got off the ground for 6 years. But in 1952, these communist records were endorsed by the Book of the Month Club. That's one reason why they're in hundreds of thousands of American homes tonight, including many of yours. Now, if you want that, it's in the Book of the Month Club news for January 1952. Not only do they recommend children's records Gill, but they have a brochure out on them. Number two, you school teachers, listen to this. Your own official magazine called Grade Teacher has recommended these communist records. Grade Teacher for February 1962 on page 122 recommends young people's records. Three, there's a little newspaper on the East Coast called the New York Times. They have endorsed these communist records. In fact, on the jacket labels of many of these records, it'll say Best in Children's Records, New York Times. Now, of course, they are the best in children's records. You understand that. If you want your young people mentally ill. And then you have a little pink sheet up here on the coast called the San Francisco Chronicle. By the way, I just talked to them tonight. They have endorsed these communist records. Wait till they hear this. I didn't tell them about that. It takes three lines in this report right here to give their endorsement of these red records. This Week magazine has endorsed these communist records. Music Teachers Quarterly has endorsed these communist records. Now look, this is a 33 and a third album. At the top it says, Young People's Records, Children's Record Guild, approved by boards of education and in daily use in thousands of schools in all 50 states and Canada. Look here, ladies. These red records have been endorsed or have been guaranteed by good housekeeping. And they have been recommended by Parent Magazine. Now look, it's rather obvious that Gus Hall did not come to your home one night, you know, and go, I'm Gus, General Secretary of the Communist Party, and I have a few records to sell you tonight. That isn't how Gus operates. Gus spends his time on your college campuses with a big grin. Peddling his criminal conspiracy called communism, but it's all of course.
Wir testen den Geschmack einer ganz
Fertig?
Besonderen Margarine.
Lass sehen, wer von euch seine Zehen berühren kann. So, Brüder und Schwestern, wir beugen jetzt den ganzen Oberkörper bis zur
Hüfte. Geschmack auf alle Fälle. Kaum zu glauben, dass es Margarine ist, ja.
Das höre ich öfter.
Ja, ich finde es schmeckt kräftig und einfach irgendwie vollmundig.
Und Ihre Familie?
Ich das möchte ich
meiner
sehen.
Mutter mal angeboten.
Jeder Mensch unter 45 ist fähig, seine Zehenspitzen mit den Händen zu berühren.
Auch Sie werden staunen, wenn Sie probieren. Bonella hat den Geschmack getroffen.
Notable visitor to Eglin Air Force Base was President Kennedy, guest for the special occasion of General Curtis LeMay.
So, America's
Vice President Johnson and Air Secretary Zucker's
Force.
It's not all guided missiles now. In the field of conventional weapons are the deadly napalm.
Heute werden 6,3 Millionen Traktoren hergestellt. Das macht eine Ertragssteigerung von 33,5.
The President saw a demonstration of refueling.
Ist eine fabelhafte Sache, Worte zu zerstören. Hast du eigentlich das 10. Neusprechdiktionär?
A plane with no pilot was the target of fighters, which with
das
rockets
heißt,
made
dass die Revolution abgeschlossen ist, wenn die Sprache
das Geheimnis liegt in der Übersetzung von direkten Gedanken zur kürzesten Sprache. Dann könnte ich auch niemand mit dir einer Meinung sein. Sehr richtig. Es ist ein ermutigender Gedanke zu wissen, dass aller spätestens im Jahre 2050 kein Mensch mehr in der Lage sein wird, eine Unterhaltung wie diese zu verstehen.
Das heißt, dass die Revolution abgeschlossen ist, wenn die Sprache perfekt ist.
Das Geheimnis liegt in der Übersetzung vom direkten Gedanken zur kürzesten Sprachform. Dann könnte ich auch nie mehr mit dir einer Meinung sein. Sehr richtig. Es ist ein ermutigender Gedanke zu wissen, dass aller spätestens im Jahre 2050 kein Mensch mehr in der Lage sein wird, eine Unterhaltung wie diese zu verstehen.
1,2 Millionen Handel.
Schmeckt Doppel Plus gut. Ich glaube, Doppel Plus gut.
Brüder und Schwestern, wir haben die Produktionsschlacht gewonnen. Die uns vorliegenden Ergebnisse zeigen eindeutig, dass der Lebensstandard im letzten Jahr um nicht weniger als 20% gestiegen ist. Überall hat es unter den Parteiarbeitern spontane Demonstrationen der Freude und Dankbarkeit gegeben. Aufgrund der Übererfüllung des 9. Dreijahresplanes wird die Schokoladenration auf 25 Gramm pro Woche erhöht.
Ich bin sexuell pervers und ein Gedankenverbrecher. Ich habe meine Vertrauensposition im Ministerium des Friedens ausgenutzt, um unsere Alliierten ihn zu täuschen und auch um die Jugend zu verderben.
Ist auf Kosten des Hauses.
Der Literatur und Drogen. Ich erkläre mich in allen Punkten für schuldig und ich bitte Sie nur noch, mir zu glauben, dass ich unseren Führer wirklich liebe.
Freiheit ist Sklaverei. Unwissenheit ist Stärke. Ein Triumph der Willenskraft.
My fellow Americans, I stand here with all that feel as I do, disgusted with this lie that Biden has been chosen, as if we all don't know the truth. And when one tries to deceive, we know that one can't get away with it. There will be a price to pay. The ones who are jumping for joy now are jumping toward the horror they will be in for. Because I know that the promises being made from the left to the American people will never come to be. My friends of all colors, races, and religions, this is now our greatest fight since the Civil War. The battle of righteousness versus Satan. Yes, Satan. Because these leftists are evil, corrupt. And they want to tear down this nation. We must not allow this. We must fight this corruption that has taken over and fight for the good that seems lost. Let us give our trust to God and fight now for Trump's victory, because we all know this ballot count is corruption like they are. So let us not back down. Let us fight this fight as if it is our last fight on Earth.
We interrupt our normal program to cooperate in security and civil defense measures as requested by the government. This is a radio alert. Normal broadcasting will now be discontinued for an indefinite period. Civil defense information will be broadcast in most areas at 6:40 and 12:40 on your regular radio receiver. I repeat, normal broadcasting will be discontinued for an indefinite period. Civil defense information will be broadcast in most areas at 6:40 and 12:40 on your regular radio receiver.
Your
열심하면 한다. 저 쓰는 한다면 한다. 전군님의 승리의 영도 따라서 전군의 붉은 기 그 신념으로 저 쓰는 결심하면 한다. 저 쓰는 한다면 한다. 조체의 강성대국을 우리 어떻게 이 땅에 세우는가를 세계여봐라. 조선은 결심하면 한다. 조선은 한다면 한다. 정부님의 국의 뜻을 받들어 불굴의 정신력 조선은 결심하면 한다. 조선은 한다면 한다. 결심하면 한다. 조선은 한다면 한다.
Der mensheid, van grootheid, roem en kracht, van macht en van gerechtigheid. Voorwaarts met glorie der mensheid, die met ons zal zijn, zoals hij ook met en bij onze vaderen was. Voorwaarts, zijn oder nicht zijn, heeft Wilhelm gezegd. Leven of dood.
Er komt een dag na elke nacht. Voorbij trekt iedere wolk. Ik zie hoe het eerste morgenlicht door het hoge venster draalt. Glorie der mensheid maakt mij het sterven licht. En zo ik heb gefaald, gelijk een elk wel falen kan, schenk mij dan uw genade. Opdat ik heen ga als een man, als ik voor de lopen sta.
Als u na het schokkende programma behoefte aan hebt om met iemand te praten, bel dan gerust dit nummer 035-83-88.
Gaat en onderwijst alle volken. We'll be right back.
capito basta nena delle black spirale non feda da quando le imbudi gasta spiegan le ferma di ventria quando tu si fa chi Touren. Er sagt sich nur Papiere, hört nie auf Touren. Er fühlt sich weit und erleuchtet, denn er zog sich seine Zunge mit Schmerz verfeuchtet. Das wahre Leben, wo die Geister spielen, hat Wärmann seinen Sinn. Besser mit ich hin. Abgehoben, abgefahren. Hermann, wo bist du? Abgetreten. Hermann, wo bist du? Hermann, es hat. Er sagt sich Schäfer, Master, Opa, ja. Mit negativen Vibrationen konnte sich Hermann mit dir verschonen. Das wahre Leben kann ich einfach so erleben. Er braucht die Spritze und die Pillen, um sich überhaupt damit zu füllen. Die Wand kippt um. Ja Gott, und die Decke kommt runter. Und der Teppich. Und immer tiefer und immer tiefer in die Worten and have been taken us.
Mama! Papa!
Open Marken! Polizei! Abgehoben, abgefahren. Hermann, wo bist du? Ey, weggetreten, abgetreten. Hermann, wo bist du? Hermann ist hoch!
Merci.
Spies Are Us, a history of the CIA. Presented by Tom Mangold. Program 1. The Focus of Evil.
The toughest question to ask an intelligence is, what do they think? It's relatively easy to count the missiles and the bombs and the tanks and so forth. Well, it's not easy, it's expensive, it's complicated, but you can do it. But to try and get a sense of what do they really think, what do they know, that's difficult.
What do they think? What do they know? Herb Mayer, former special assistant to the director of Central Intelligence, defining the jewels of intelligence acquisition. Defining it as one thing, implementing as another. Especially when the CIA's principal target was the almost impregnable Soviet Union. By the 1980s, that failure to find out what the Kremlin was actually thinking very nearly made the Cold War hot. How did messages and perceptions between the superpowers become so distorted? Why was the intelligence take so bad? That's what I'll be looking at in this first part of my series on key moments in the CIA's history. A history that began with its birth in 1947 on a presidential directive from Harry Truman. Mel Goodman, who was to serve the agency for 20 years as a senior Soviet analyst.
The CIA was formed to do intelligence analysis and intelligence research. The covert action capability was given to the CIA in 1952, 5 years later, and it was over the protests of many high-ranking CIA officials who felt the major mission and the mission that President Harry Truman wanted to pursue was one objective branch of government, not part of the policy process, that would give intelligence analysis and assessments to the president, to the administration, that would not be grinding a policy axe. It would have no policy interest or parochialism or spin whatsoever.
And the target?
The target was the Soviet Union. This was the beginning of the Cold War, but the origins of the CIA would be Pearl Harbor.
The national trauma of Pearl Harbor and the surprise Japanese attack on the U.S. Navy's fleet was the event that ultimately led to Truman's creation of the CIA, a civilian central intelligence agency empowered to make sure that America would never again be caught unawares. It would snoop around the world and warn its major client, the president in the White House here in Washington, of all likely threats to America's national security. Now, top of that threat list was Stalin's Soviet Union. One of the agency's first operations was to counter Soviet political expansion into Western Europe. Greece was threatened, so was Italy, where in 1948 the communists stood a chance of winning national elections. Intelligence officers working with Secretary of State George Marshall, whom Truman had put in charge of American reconstruction in Europe, knew what he wanted done.
General Marshall was a four-star general, and his thought about the Russians was just something horrid, you know. And he pushed us all to come up with ideas. Go to that little newspaper and have them publish the damn thing. And we've got to get this country rolling, and the only thing is, we defeat the communists.
Mark Wyatt, later CIA station chief in Rome, remembers the scene on the evening of the election.
I was invited to the Hassler Hotel overlooking all of Rome, and General Marshall was there. Champagne was poured, and there were a whole group of satchels that had money in them, obviously. And the satchels varied in size depending upon the party. 8-9 million at that time was a lot of money. And the reports that they had received from how hard that party was working against the communists.
Italy was the CIA's first real success and showed the value of knowing the territory, having local networks, and a generous supply of slush fund dollars. The problem for the CIA was that it was unable to repeat this where it mattered most, inside the Soviet Union. With virtually no networks on the ground, it was reduced to debriefing travelers returning from business in Russia, people whose intelligence value was often minimal. There were times in the early 50s when the agency didn't even know the price of potatoes in Moscow. Hardly surprising, then, that there were similar intelligence failures at the highest level. The launch of Sputnik, the world's first ever satellite, came as a total and deeply unwelcome shock in Washington. So the CIA turned to that invariable American fallback, technological superiority. As Dick Kerr, number two at the agency in the late 80s and early 90s, recalls, the age of the mechanical spook was born.
Our major problem was the nature of the Soviet strategic capability. What military forces did they have? How were they going to use them? How were they changing and modernizing their military? And those are the very things that one can monitor most easily with technical intelligence, with imagery, overhead imagery, and signals intelligence, and all the other technical means.
But technological prowess doesn't fulfill Herb Meyer's dictum, what do they think, what do they know, as the Soviets realized only too well.
With the help of the signal intelligence, you can establish how many missiles are on the enemy's territories and their combat readiness, but only by penetrating the human's mind, you can learn if these missiles are going to be launched. And if yes, when? So, in the KGB, they believe that there is no substitute for the human intelligence.
Yuri Shvets, a sharp young agent of the KGB's Washington Bureau, or residency, in the 1980s. There's no doubt that Soviet spy rings were demonstrably successful in the West. The Portland Ring, led by the infamous Krogers, spied on Britain's submarine base on the South Coast. The Rosenbergs in America stole atomic secrets for their KGB masters in Moscow. A serious problem, one of which the CIA was unaware until it was far too late, was the paranoid character of James Jesus Angleton, its legendary head of counterintelligence. He became convinced, quite wrongly, that virtually every Soviet defected to the West was a double agent deliberately dispatched by the KGB to deceive. So time and again, the intelligence take from these vital sources was discounted and ignored. This, in turn, left the CIA over-reliant on its technology. The policymakers in Washington also needed to know what were the Soviets' intentions. One way to find out was to investigate and analyze the Soviet Union's economy. Many answers would flow from that.
I think you start with a long heritage of misunderstanding and overestimating the size and efficiency of the Soviet economy.
In other words, even that task was beyond the intelligence gatherers and analysts in CIA headquarters at Langley, just outside Washington. Arnold Horlick ought to know. Part of his career was spent as the leading CIA expert on the Soviet economy.
This was a function, perhaps, of being bedazzled by the military output of the Soviet economy, which for many years was keeping up pretty much with our own, and a few areas even doing better. But this was on the basis of an economy that was a generation behind our own. And the methodology that was employed by the agency to compare the economies, the so-called dollar-ruble conversions, in retrospect were very misleading. So, for example, the notion that the Soviet economy was half as large as ours or going toward two-thirds as large as ours, I think was grossly wrong in real touch it, see it, feel it terms. But in terms of the methodology that was employed, it sounded sensible.
But it was the wrong call, one which had profound political consequences. Richard Perle, later Assistant Secretary of Defense under President Reagan and a key client of the CIA's analytical conclusions.
The CIA, by virtue of its underestimation of the burden on the Soviet economy of the sustained weapons buildup that was then underway, misled policymakers who were at the negotiating table. That is to say, they created a sense that if we didn't reach agreements limiting weaponry, there would be a surge in Soviet production, and we would find that they were even stronger. In fact, they were working at the maximum they could sustain, and couldn't sustain much longer.
As doubts about the accuracy and value of their intelligence were raised by the CIA's various high-powered customers, the agency was forced to solicit and listen to advice from outside its Langley headquarters. That came from a group of critical experts called Team B, people who believed that the CIA was misinterpreting data from the Soviets. This error they attributed to the agency's assumption that Soviet institutions were mirror images of their American counterparts. The CIA's own team was Team A. Dick Kerr.
There was a sense that CIA was not addressing the information it had in an objective way, that it had predetermined notions about what the outcome of its analysis should be. So a group of outsiders, which were Team B, were brought in to take another and supposedly an independent look at that information and come to its judgment. The A-team, B-team kind of concept is a valid concept. It's to bring alternative judgments to bear on complex problems. The difficulty with the A-team, B-team exercise in this case was that it was already predetermined that the B-team was going to disagree fundamentally with the other opinion.
They were more hawkish.
They were hawkish, and they were coming in to describe that more dire and pessimistic picture.
The more hawkish Team B had uncovered institutional weaknesses. For all the CIA's technology, brain power, and money, insiders knew it wasn't making the right calls, and sometimes no calls at all, about the momentous events that were happening in the real world outside. Mel Goodman.
In the analytical area of the CIA, they were surprised by Czechoslovakia in 1968. They were wrong about Hungary in 1956. They were somewhat ambivalent even about Afghanistan. And President Carter claims to this day that he was never given advance warning about the Soviet entry into Afghanistan in December of 1979. So I think the analytical component was probably too sanguine about what Soviet military intentions were.
I, Ronald Reagan, do solemnly swear
that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
That I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
Ronald Reagan being sworn into the presidency in 1981 here on the steps of the Capitol. And with his arrival, the worldview in Washington changed. Containment of the Soviet Union was out, and confrontation of the empire of evil was in.
Before Reagan, virtually every leader of every party had the same objective, which was to not lose the Cold War.
Herb Mayer was special assistant to the new CIA chief.
President Reagan came in with a very different objective. He said, I want to win. Because he had a different objective, he was open to a different form of intelligence. If your objective is to win, then you look for your adversary's vulnerability. If your objective is to not lose, you tend to be more focused on your enemy's strengths because you're only playing defense. So President Reagan shifted us from defense to offense. That was an enormous difference.
It was unmistakable. Defense spending in the West soared. Cruise and Pershing II missiles were deployed in Western Europe. The American Air Force and Navy stepped up spying and probing operations right at the edge of Soviet borders. The CIA, under the new leadership of the irascible old Cold Warrior Bill Casey, launched an aggressive operation to force the Soviet adventure in Afghanistan onto the defensive. Within the Soviet Empire, Poland's Solidarity Trade Union received special CIA donations and equipment. The superpower balance began to tilt. So how did the aging Soviet leadership react, now under Yuri Andropov, former head of the KGB? Oleg Kalugin, a former KGB general himself, currently enjoying capitalist business adventures in his old target city of Washington.
One day we received a cable from Moscow, urgent, signed by Andropov. And in effect it said that at no time after World War II the Soviet Union and the West were closer to another war. And for that reason, he said, because of the United States government and its Western allies now preparing for a major military or aggressive act, which was not specified, we must be fully mobilized and the intelligence and counterintelligence services and all the military now on full alert.
But Andropov was a sensible man, former head of the KGB, now first secretary. You must have been stunned when you got that. You must have thought, what on earth is going on?
It was truly based on fear. The Soviet Union at the time was slowly degenerating. So this kind of hysteria was a reflection of the Soviet assessment of the Western potential and our lack of that ability to follow and compete with them.
And it got worse for Moscow. By the spring of 1983, President Reagan was telling Americans,
"What if free people could live secure in the knowledge that their security did not rest upon the threat of instant U.S. retaliation to deter a Soviet attack, that we could intercept and destroy strategic ballistic missiles before they reached our own soil or that of our allies?"
The Strategic Defense Initiative, dubbed Star Wars, was a trillion-dollar plan to make the U.S. invulnerable to a nuclear attack. This plan, seen from Moscow, seemed to spell the end of the policy of nuclear deterrence which had maintained a balance of terror and peace for over 30 years. Furthermore, it was a system the Soviets could match with neither technology nor hard cash. They began to panic. Arms talks with the Americans were abandoned. And then,
"While they preach the supremacy of the state, declare its omnipotence over individual man, and predict its eventual domination of all peoples on the earth, they are the focus of evil in the modern world."
The temperature of the Cold War dropped below freezing. And then,
"Washington has accused the Soviet Union of shooting down a South Korean airliner which disappeared overnight off northern Japan. The State Department says the Boeing 747 was brought down with a missile and a Russian pilot..."
The U.S. reaction from Ambassador to the UN Jean Kirkpatrick was calculated and revealing.
"Quite simply, the Soviets decided to shoot down a civilian airliner, shot it down, murdering the 269 persons on board, and lied about it."
Now began a remarkable period in Soviet post-war history, a moment completely missed or misread by the CIA. Convinced by all these events that the Americans were preparing for war, the Soviets in turn launched Operation Rhiann to look for signs that the West was about to launch a nuclear first strike. This is how an increasingly paranoid Soviet leadership briefed its KGB spies at the Washington Residency. Yuri Shvets.
There were guys in our residency whose job was every night to drive around. One guy was driving around Pentagon, another guy was driving around the State Department, the White House, etc., the key government institution, and to watch how many lights are on, if there are too many lights, unusually many lights. That was supposed to be a signal. I remember one day we received a circular cable from Moscow, meaning that it went out to all major stations, saying, "Look, guys, this is how you should work on Brian." And they quote this particular episode when the London station reported to Center that the British government announced recruitment of donors to donate blood. So the station reported to Moscow that we believe this is a part of the preparation of the British government for the nuclear war. It's a part of the Rand program. And the head of the service, Khrushchev, said they knew that they would be preparing for this kind of war. And this is the proof. So this is a vicious circle.
So perfectly ordinary activities like seeking new blood donors suddenly assumed the most menacing interpretations. The FBI, who shadowed the known KGB officers, was baffled by this new and seemingly pointless touring of Washington by night, such as here at the Pentagon. And then in November 1983, a military exercise called Able Archer, unfortunately timed, took NATO forces through the full-scale simulated release of nuclear weapons. Seen from Moscow, the dots were now joining up, suggesting the nightmare of war. But what really lay behind this perception?
The paranoia was by itself pretty much dangerous, because any margin of error of assessment of this paranoia by itself could lead to a disaster. Had the Soviet leadership during the time of Cuban Missile Crisis had the same kind of paranoia they had in the 80s, I believe the outcome of the missile crisis in 62 could have been absolutely different.
So do you believe that the CIA should have programmed